All right, so the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradvold, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Diane B. Bradvold presiding.
All right, and today's date is July 29th, 2020. We are here today, and I think counsel before us, to hear the third matter on our oral argument calendar. So counsel, I know you've received instructions on what to do if by chance you were to lose visual or audio. We are handling this argument today via WebEx in light of the current public health orders, and so we very much appreciate you appearing today in this format. So with that, I will have the marshal call the first case. I'll have a couple more remarks before we go ahead with the argument. Marshal, go right ahead.
Sure. Now calling it file number 819-1156 in regards to the marriage of Amanda Jo Briggs, petitioner respondent, versus Kent Stewart Mitchell Briggs for appellant.
All right, and counsel, just a couple of additional things. You're probably familiar with our rules and how we proceed. One unique one for this WebEx format is that we ask you when you are not speaking to have your mute button on. Of course, you know, change that when it's your turn to speak. And you'll see the judges do the same thing. We do that to improve our audio quality as well as the quality of the recording. And then before you start your remarks, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent and keep your eye on the clock. So the marshal will have a smartphone visible for you. You can see your 15 minutes counting down, or appellant, you have your optional 5-minute rebuttal. It will give you that amount when we get to that point. So with that, I'm going to turn on my mute button and I will let counsel for appellant proceed when she's ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May I please the court? My name is Beth Verbosa, and I represent the appellant, Kent Briggs, who is present in my conference room this morning. By way of a little bit of background on this matter, the parties were married on October 9th, 2010, and they have two minor children. The respondent commenced the dissolution action in May of 2017. Prior to the party's marriage, they executed an antenuptial agreement on or about March 26, 2010. There was an evidentiary hearing held regarding the validity of the antenuptial agreement on September 6, 2018. After that evidentiary hearing, there was a trial that was held on February 5th, 6th, and March 6th of 2019. The judgment and decree was entered on June 24th, 2019. The court awarded the respondent attorney's fees in the amount of $68,793 for need-based attorney's fees. In addition, the court also awarded the respondent conduct-based attorney's fees in the amount of $24,525. The appellant appeals the district court's decision for the following reasons. First, the record does not support the appellant has the means to contribute to the respondent's attorney's fees. According to Minnesota Statute, Section 518.14, Subdivision 1 states that the district court can award attorney's fees if there is a need, if a payor has the ability to contribute. Chronic v. Chronic, 482 Northwest 2nd, 533 Minnesota Appellate Court, 1992, states that there needs to be sufficient findings to support an award of attorney's fees. Unlike Gully v. Gully, 599 Northwest 2nd, 814 Minnesota, 1999, the district court was not familiar with the history of the party's assets. This was obvious by the fact that the district court overlooked several key factors. First, the appellant received only approximately $37,547 in the marital assets. The respondent received approximately $176,445.
Ms. Barbosa, could I interrupt you just a moment, please? Sure. With regard to assets and your client's ability to pay, our court in the Bernberg decision concluded that it was not error to consider non-marital assets. It seems from my review of the order that's clearly what the court considered and didn't focus solely on the $37,000 versus her marital share, but at the non-marital. Do you see, despite our court's, do you have any basis subsequent perhaps to our court's decision in 1991 that would be an error?
Thank you, Your Honor. Unlike Berenberg versus Berenberg, The appellant in that case had about $1.3 million non-marital assets. And the appellant in this case before the court had non-marital assets of only approximately $265,000. But what the court also has to remember is that Ward v. Ward states that in order to make an invasion of non-marital assets, there needs to be a specific finding to support that apportionment of non-marital assets. And the court did not do that in this case. The court also has to find that there needs to be a finding of unfair hardship versus in Walter v. Walter, 395 Northwest 2nd 417. And again, the court did not do that in this case. The court did not even address the hardship factor in reviewing the non-marital assets and awarding the
Can I follow up with that?
Sure.
Barbosa respondent in her brief noted that the court did not in fact order an invasion of non-marital assets but simply ordered payment of the legal fees. And is that not the issue though that Barenberg was getting at, that that itself is not an error for the court to consider non-marital?
I don't think so.
Without invading.
Sorry, Your Honor. What I think the court in Barenberg states is that while there may not be an error in considering it, I think we still need to make a specific finding that the court has, if the court is going to invade the non-marital assets in order to award attorney's fees, that there needs to be that specific finding. And the court did not do that in this particular case. If the court, in actuality, if you look at the distribution, if the appellant is supposed to pay $93,000 of attorney's fees, he is actually having to invade his non-marital assets of $265,000, which then shifts over to the petitioner, which really the court then is doing is equalizing the assets of invading the non-marital assets so that she can pay her attorney's fees. Again, I would argue to the court that if the district court is going to do that, there needs to be a specific finding of undue hardship. And there was none in this order from the district court. And so not only that, Your Honor, there's the court failed to look at and take into consideration whether or not my client had the ability to pay it from his income as well. Not only did the appellant not have the assets to pay in regards to marital, and then the fact that the district court did not make a specific finding in order to invade his non-marital assets. The court also failed to look at the appellant's income. And if you look at that, his net income was approximately $5,200 per month. The respondent wants the court to look at the gross income of $12,000, and that is not what this court or the district court should be looking at in awarding need-based attorney's fees. We need to look at the net income of the appellant's income, and thus in particularly in regards to Geske versus Merkelina. And at that time, the respondents or the appellant's income was $5,288. He also had expenses of about $4,900 per month. Again, we put in our brief that the appellant was also paying other expenses. One was the mortgage as well, and that mortgage payment was about $2,400. So if you take the $2,400 and his expenses of $4,900, he did not have enough net income to meet his own monthly income at $5,288. Whereas if you look at the respondent also had income of approximately $4,200 plus also another $1,623 for child support, which her total income was approximately $5,823 per month.
Counsel, wasn't her child support designated to support the children? So is it appropriate to consider that in determining her ability to pay?
Your Honor, I think when we're looking at the total amount that she's receiving and looking at her monthly expenses, which do include some expenses for the children, it's approximately $4,600. So she has an additional $1,623 available to her. But not only that, Your Honor, I would like to go back to during the dissolution action, she was also receiving approximately $4,000 of spousal maintenance per month, plus another $2,100 for child support. Her monthly expenses at that time was $2,800 per month. And that was from the temporary hearing. So she had an excess amount of income that was available to her to contribute to her monthly expenses. And
a question for you about respondents' ability to pay. One thing that wasn't entirely clear to me from the briefs is there some portion of respondents' attorneys' fees that weren't awarded to her? In other words, is there any information in the record as to her total attorney's fees for the underlying litigation compared to the amount that the court awarded?
I believe, Your Honor, that the court award, that in the judgment decree states that she had about approximately $125,000 of attorney's fees, of which my client is supposed to pay $93,000.
Okay, thank you. That's right. Now I'm recalling that now. Thank you.
Yeah. I see I'm running out a little bit of time, so I wanted to touch a little bit on
back to that point. Doesn't that go to her ability to pay them, that she still has a significant amount of attorney's fees that aren't being covered?
That's true, Your Honor. But however, if my client, if you look at the statute says her need and the payer's ability to pay. She may have a need, but the payer may not have the ability to pay. So it's not automatic just because she has a need that the appellant needs to pay her attorney's fees. There's a balancing test that the court needs to take into consideration, which I don't believe that the district court did at the time that it issued its order, and at least not fully. Not taking into consideration the appellant's ability to pay the amount of marital funds that were awarded to him. I would like to quickly move on to, I only have a couple more minutes to move on to the other two issues, Your Honor, is that the court also awarded another approximate $14,000 for attorney's fees for a hearing, temporary hearing of November 14th of 2017. In that order, the court had already ordered my client to pay $15,000 to cover the fees in that matter. The respondent's attorney's fees from November 1st to November, respondent's attorney's fees at that time of October 31st, which is in the court's order, was approximately $10,913.50. And therefore, the court ordered my client to pay $15,000 to cover the fees in that matter. The court ordering my client to pay another approximately $14,000 for that same matter is a duplicate fee. And I would argue to the court that that was an error in the district court's judgment decree.
Ms. Barbosa, the judge in that initial order reserved designating the fees, whether that be an advancement, conduct, or needs-based. Was there ever, and I didn't see it, but perhaps you could point me to it, or was it part of the stipulation, was there any reference to that fees and how it ought to be designated?
No, Your Honor, and that's the problem, is that the stipulated agreement never took that into consideration, and so therefore it was just paid out of my client's income at the time, but he paid the $5,000. So that was never addressed in the stipulated agreement. And so, again, that's where my argument is that it's he paid that $15,000 at the time where when the district court had reserved that issue. It was never addressed in the judgment decree, even a recognition, a recognition of that he had already made that payment. I want to move on to the last issue here, which is the conduct-based attorney's fees. Again, the court awarded $20,000 for the evidentiary hearing on September 6, 2018. And the court in the judgment decree also ordered conduct-based attorney's fees for that same hearing of approximately $24,000. Again, this is a duplicate fee. The judgment decree and also the order from September 6, 2018 hearing, the court was very clear that the $20,000 would cover what the court was concerned about, maybe a decrease or of the marital funds for having to litigate this matter. And so therefore, our position is that this is a duplicate fee of $20,000 that was already paid, and now the court is asking appellant to pay another $24,000 for that same hearing, which then would be a $44,000 of fees paid to for the same hearing. And my client is asking that the court reverse the district court's orders on these issues.
Thank you, counsel. With that, I'll ask the marshal to reset the clock so that we're ready for the respondent's argument. Looks like he's ready. And counsel for respondent, you can begin when you are ready.
May it please your court. Good morning. I am Ruta Johnson, and I am appearing today on behalf of respondent in this appeal, Ms. Amanda Mandy Briggs. The Briggs matter was pending before the court for 2 years. It included three motions, and these motions had hundreds of pages of submissions that included financial records and the party's financial circumstances. Again, this matter culminated in a four-day bifurcated trial where the court was again presented with hundreds of pages of submissions, exhibits, 3 days worth of testimony at the very end, and 1 day of testimony for the antenuptial trial. And the court, based on all of this record, I mean, the party's record is, it's massive. There is a lot of information here that the court had the ability to consider in awarding Ms. Briggs conduct and need-based attorney fees. The court did not err. And we know from prior cases that the Court of Appeals rarely disturbs a attorney fee award, and this case should be no different. We are here because Mr. Briggs did not get what he wanted. The court did not buy into his narrative, had significant concerns about Mr. Briggs's credibility, and discounted his testimony accordingly. And it was Mr. Briggs's remarkable behavior that was recognized by the court and evident in the record and evident in the court's order that resulted ultimately in the amount of fees that Ms. Briggs incurred and the court awarded for her. Your Honors, I will first...
Mr. Johnson, can I inquire as to that issue? The court seemed to also make findings that either neither or maybe it was more... accurately described that other than that hearing on the antenuptial agreement, arguably both parties were expanding their need for legal fees. So another way to look at that, I guess, as I read into that, is perhaps both parties incurred too much legal fees that neither party can pay, generally speaking, related to the issues. My question is that I assume there's no dispute that at least as to the marital assets, that your client did receive the majority of those. And other than our court's decision in 1991, I'm not aware of any, unless you can point that to me, where the court specifically, or not specifically, but impliedly, does require dipping into the non-marital assets without making reference to the cause or the need to do so. And that's why appellant points that out. And I didn't see any findings with the court doing so, but it's clear from the numbers that that's what he would need to do. Would you agree or can you point me to case law other than Bernberg in that one statement where it's not error to consider it, the court did not abuse its discretion in such a lopsided number otherwise without making those kind of findings?
Your Honor, based on my review in preparation of our appeal brief, I was not able to find any cases that would say that consideration of a non-marital award and even perhaps a belief by the person who is responsible for paying these attorney fees that they're going to have to dip into that non-marital award, that that's error on behalf of the court. Based on my review of the cases and specifically the cases referenced by Your Honor, it's appropriate for the court to consider the amount of non-marital assets awarded to the party expected to pay these attorney fees. It's part of the package. It's part of the consideration. I would also like to address Your Honor's comment about trial court recognizing that both parties perhaps contributed to some extent to the legal fees. And the court addressed this issue in its findings in the final order. If I may direct your attention to appellant's addendum page 34, it's finding of fact 145. The court very clearly grapples with this issue that Ms. Briggs was constantly put in the position where she had to defend herself against Mr. Briggs and a variety of claims. And on a number of occasions, she really attempted to work with him, but was constantly met by Mr. Briggs with a no. And the court recognizes specifically that it is disingenuous to suggest that a large portion of wife's legal strategy is unreasonable or delayed or contributed to the expense of the proceedings because Ms. Briggs wouldn't have been able to prevail or even put forth some of her defenses against Mr. Briggs insisting that she was a drug fiend or that she was an unfit mother. It was a lot of legal work to continue to push the case forward that was recognized by the court. I would also suggest to this court that even though both parties' conduct may be a consideration and where both parties' conduct contributes to the length and expense of the proceedings, we know that in conduct-based fees, that would not be appropriate, but it's the court recognized that it was only Mr. Briggs' conduct that rose to the level to contribute to these fees and then required an award of fees to Ms. Briggs.
Can I inquire, I'm assuming you're referring to the order with the regard to the antenuptial agreement proceeding, the first day of trial, as it's called, in September, I believe, because that's where the court, in its final order, made specific findings related to that. My question for you, and this has to do with the argument regarding duplication, and as I look at the court's order after the antenuptial hearing, the court made references to, in particular, Mr. Briggs underwent significant expense to challenge the antenuptial agreement. The court reasonably estimates that this has significantly diminished the amount of fees it previously awarded and that it is reasonable to award an additional $20,000 in attorney's fees. The court is generally concerned that Mr. Briggs put the parties and the marital estate to enormous expense. I guess my question for you is, it seems without calling it conduct fees, the court was calling it conduct fees, but decided that nevertheless, and maybe I got the impression it was simply because fees are fees and whether they're conduct or certainly she had need, the judge ruled that she had need and ordered $20,000. My question is where in the order that we have under review, the current order specifically, does the court make a finding other than its statement that's non-duplicative?
Well, the court, Your Honor, the $20,000 that was awarded at the conclusion of the antenuptial trial was a need-based fees awards after the court recognized that Ms. Briggs's fees had likely been so depleted as to require additional contributions. Now, at the time of the final order, and Your Honors, I just want to make sure that you are still able to hear me because all of the video has gone blank.
Yes, we can hear you. Can you, you cannot see us, though?
I cannot see anybody, and I just want to make sure that I am not just speaking to an empty space. So I will continue.
So, Council, just so I can interject too, you've got about 7 minutes left on your clock, and please just go ahead, and I'll give you a one-minute warning.
Thank you. I appreciate it. As I was saying, the $20,000 awarded at the conclusion of the antenuptial trial was need-based fees to continue Ms. Briggs' ongoing representation in the case. And at the conclusion of the custody and divorce proceeding, when the court awarded the additional $24,000, that was specifically based on conduct. That was based on the court's findings that Mr. Briggs put the parties to this extraordinary expense and that really diminished the marital property.
Ms. Johnson, now, this is Judge Sleater. Can you point me to a particular area where the court, I'm looking at the order from the antenuptial agreement hearing, and I didn't see the phrase ongoing. I simply see the court making reference to the court defers a conduct-based decision at present because a need-based award is so clearly appropriate and will adequately address or resolve the issue. And so ordered the $20,000. So I'm struggling to find that phrase. I saw you did use that in your brief to distinguish the fees so that we can conclude that there was no abuse of discretion and there's no redundancy.
Your Honor, I believe that the court made some comments as to the fees at the conclusion of the trial. So there's some mention of it at in the transcript, and I apologize, I don't have the citation right in front of me, but it's clear from the language of the court that this is meant for the ongoing representation and need-based fees. And just because need-based fees are awarded, it doesn't mean that a conduct-based fees for this proceeding is not appropriate. The need-based fees has always been, and as is evident from the record, for ongoing representation so that Ms. Briggs can see through this case from beginning to the end. The antenuptial agreement or the antenuptial trial was part of the bifurcated trial that lasted for 4 days. And so it would be unreasonable to separate the two proceedings and view them as separate events and strictly interpret that whatever the award may have been is only for that day and cannot continue or cannot be applied to the other days.
Ms. Johnson, would you agree with what Ms. Barbosa mentioned about the temporary hearing fees, that there's no resolution as to the court reserved the issue of how to allocate those? Would it be fair then for us to presume from the entire file that those are also needs-based fees?
If I understand your question, Your Honor, correctly, from our perspective, the court award, the $15,000 fee award was a need-based case for ongoing representation again, and that the award at the time of the trial was for conduct-based fees. There was some question on whether there was an allocation appropriately of what was an advancement of Ms. Briggs' marital estate. However, the party submitted to the court a fully executed property settlement agreement for the court's consideration, and it would have been up to the parties at that point to decide how that is going to be determined. It was not up for the court to then investigate further at the time of our second day of trial, which would have been the first day of the final trial, to investigate this agreement to see did we properly account for what was an advancement in property and did we not. The court was presented with this agreement that these are the terms that were comfortable. The court was aware from this agreement that there was a Karen waiver. There was a lot of there was consideration for the Karen waiver based on Mr. Briggs' waiver of his non-marital claim in the party's homestead. So again, it would have been up to Mr. Briggs at that point to note to the court that this is an issue that still is disputed. That was not done. I noticed that I'm running out of time, and I would like to point the court also to the fact that the judge...
Counsel, I'll just let you know you've got a little over 2 minutes left, in case you're wondering.
Thank you. And Your Honor, your pictures did come back, and I'm able
to... Oh, excellent. Very good.
I would like to point the court to all of the findings that were made that support the court's assertion and finding that Mr. Briggs does have the means to pay these fees. The record is replete with information about his income. The court made findings about his income. The court made findings about the variety of perks that Mr. Briggs gets from his employer, such as HSA contributions that significantly reduces expenses, such as his SEP IRA contributions. The court made findings about child support, about spousal maintenance. The court had also considered these issues at a prior hearing, and it was appropriate for the court to rely on those prior findings in determining whether there was means. There are a number of findings that are not included under the umbrella of need or conduct-based fees, but it's clear that the judge was intimately familiar with the party's financial situation to determine that Mr. Briggs did have the means to contribute to Ms. Briggs' attorney fees, and that Ms. Briggs did not have the means. And to the point that Judge Cochran made earlier, is the record does show that Ms. Briggs had fees that were over and above the $93,000 that were awarded to her at the time of the trial. And so any alleged surplus, which there was none, certainly no evidence in the record to support that she was sitting on this windfall based on the payments that Mr. Briggs had made to her. She still had an ongoing obligation to her attorney's office to continue to pay those fees.
Counsel, this is Judge Cochran. Just briefly before you end, and I'm sorry to interrupt when you have so little time left, but I'm still not entirely clear why the $14,000 award, need-based award for the 2017 temporary relief motion isn't duplicative of the $15,000 that was awarded related to that as well. Could you clarify that for me?
Certainly. In the temporary motion, when Ms. Briggs was awarded the need-based fees, the $15,000 was for her ongoing representation. And the $14,309 was for fees incurred for having to bring the temporary motion. So if I may finalize my answer, and I know that I'm out of time, when the court examined this entire case, the trial judge was able to determine that the fees that he thought at the time of the temporary hearing, that was months and months before this final trial, that what he thought was going to be reasonable paled in comparison to what was actually reasonable. So both of those awards, the $15,000 for ongoing representation to get Ms. Briggs to the end of the dissolution action, was appropriate, as well as compensating her for the fees that she had to incur specifically at the temporary order. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, counsel. And I think we're ready for appellant, if you are ready to proceed with your 5-minute rebuttal. The marshal's resetting the clock.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to touch on this need-based attorney's fees for the temporary hearing. Again, I think that respondent's attorney is misplaced in her argument to state that it was for ongoing attorney's fees. It was very clear at the time when the temporary order came out, the respondent's attorney set forth in the motion documents that her fees as of October 31st, 2017 was $10,000 at that time, approximately. So the court ordered a $15,000 for that temporary hearing to, for that matter specifically. The $15,000 is tied to the temporary hearing. Again, I would also like to emphasize again in regards to this $20,000 for the antinomial agreement. The court was very clear in its September 6, 2018 order that the reason why the court was awarding $20,000 was the fact that it was concerned that the marital estate was depleted for that hearing to litigate that antinomial agreement. The court stated in the September 6, 2018 order that it felt by awarding the $20,000 for that portion of the litigation for that matter would take care of the court's concern. To now come back and say, oh, by the way, appellant, you now owe another $24,000 for that hearing, is duplicate of those fees. I don't understand how the district court can say and can rationalize the fact that the appellant has to pay $44,000 for the same trial in the evidentiary hearing of the antinomial agreement. If the court is going to look at conduct-based attorney's fees for that period, then the court should take the difference between the $24,000 and the $20,000 that was already paid. Then the conduct-based fees for that hearing would have been about a $4,000. So in wrapping this up, Your Honors, I would like the court to just remember that the appellant has already paid $15,000 of attorney's fees for the respondent, the $20,000 for the respondent, and which was tied to the antinomial. And then at the very beginning, when the respondent started the commencement of the dissolution action, she paid and used appellant's credit card to pay $20,000 for the initial retainer fee, which my client is now responsible to pay as part of the debt that he took on. So again, he's paid $55,000. Now to ask him to pay another $68,793 in need-based attorney's fees and another $24,525, that puts the appellant to pay the respondent attorney's fees approximately $150,000 of attorney's fees that the appellant would be responsible to pay in this proceeding. This is not a get-rich case here. The appellant and the respondent had only approximately $200,000 in marital assets. This is not, both parties were found to have contributed to the length and expense of this proceeding. The court noted that a big part of the respondent's arguments at court had to do with, you know, sexual stuff and things that didn't even matter to the court, where that the court discounted the fees at trial because of the fact that there were issues brought up that were not relevant to the matter. So I'm asking the court today to reverse the award of $93,318 in attorney's fees, not only because some of them are duplicative, but also the fact that my client does not have the ability to contribute to the need-based attorney's fees, and also the fact that he has already paid $55,000. Thank you.
Hi, thanks to both counsel today. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate the chance to hear from you before we take this matter into consideration. So at this point, the matter is submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. And again, our thanks to both of you. That was very helpful. So with that, we've concluded our oral arguments for today, and this court is in recess for its conference. Thanks so much to both counsel.